The headlines this hour: Britain's rail network is operating at 1/5 of its capacity as a strike by thousands of workers throws weekend travel into chaos. In Brazil, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva remains the front runner to win the October 2 against the incumbent Jair Bolsonaro as campaigning hits up. And at least 13 civilians are killed and many more wounded in a terrorist attack on a hotel in the Somali capital Mogadishu. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. More travel chaos across Britain as transport workers strike, demanding higher pay and better working conditions. Unions are warning that the strike could continue indefinitely unless the demands are met. Thousands, including railway and bus workers, kicked off their four-day strike on Thursday. Postal and dock workers are on strike also, bringing their sectors to a standstill. London's subway network has already grounded to a halt. Officials say only about 20% of rail network is open today. More disruption is expected tomorrow. The industrial action comes in the backdrop of worsening economic conditions. Four-decade-high inflation is driving up the cost of everything, from food to energy and clothing. The falling real wages at a record pace have been hurting millions of Britons, especially middle-income families.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities: avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true. When you're 60, why should you retire? I mean, why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living's going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers. They need more money, of course. Everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government over modernizing changes, wages and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers, such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Moving on to Brazil, which is to hold a presidential election in less than 2 months. Thousands have attended a campaign rally for the former president and leftist candidate, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, in Sao Paulo. Lula da Silva remains the front-runner to win the high-stake vote set for October the 2nd. The Workers' Party candidate is leading all polls against right-wing incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. On Tuesday, the two top polling candidates kicked off their rival campaigns for what is believed to be the country's most polarized presidential race in decades. The runoff will follow if none of the candidates garners over 50% of the vote in the first round. Polls suggest that in case of a potential second-round runoff, Lula da Silva will return to office. However, there are fears of political violence, as Bolsonaro has hinted he will not cede power if defeated. China keeping up military activities around Taiwan. Taipei says it has detected 17 Chinese warplanes and 5 warships around the island today. 4 Chinese aircraft reportedly crossed Taiwan's Straits Median Line, which is an official barrier between the two sides in normal times. This amid heightened tensions over recent trips by U.S. lawmakers to the self-ruled island, which China claims as its own territory. Beijing has recently staged drills near the island, deploying fighter jets, warships, and ballistic missiles. Taiwan accuses the Chinese army of simulating an attack. Beijing says trips by U.S. officials interfere with its internal affairs and undermine the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims have urged U.S. President Joe Biden to reverse his order and to send back billions in Afghanistan's frozen assets. Washington has been keeping Afghans' assets despite a deepening economic crisis in the country. Rahmatullah Bhagwan reports from Kabul.
1 year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the U.S. froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation, or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the U.S. and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the U.S. doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the U.S. sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The U.S. should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry and more than 1 million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Nearly 2-year conflict between the Ethiopian opposition parties has caused severe food problems for almost half of the population in the northern state of Tigray. A report by the World Food Program shows an estimated 13 million people are suffering from malnutrition across Tigray and the neighboring regions. That includes half of the pregnant and lactating women, as well as a third of children under the age of 5. The aid groups are struggling to access the population because of insufficient fuel supplies. In 2019, the government sought to merge several opposition parties into a new Prosperity Party to distance the country from ethnic politics, a move rejected by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The fighting has pushed parts of Tigray into famine conditions and killed thousands of civilians. The UN expects the situation to worsen as hopes are fading for imminent peace talks between the two parties. The terrorist attack on a hotel in the Somali capital Mogadishu has left at least 13 civilians dead and several others injured. Security sources say members of the Al-Shabaab terror group attacked the Hyatt Hotel in a hail of gunfire and explosions on Friday. They say the assault triggered an exchange of fire between security forces and the gunmen. It is still unclear whether security forces have taken back control of the hotel. Al-Shabaab later claimed responsibility. The group has been waging a deadly insurgency against Somalia's fragile central government for more than a decade. The Al-Qaeda-linked outfit often carries out attacks against government military and civilian targets in the Somali capital as well as regional towns. Turkey's main opposition party, the CHP, has criticized what it calls the government's double standards in dealing with the Palestinian cause. Criticism follows Ankara's decision to normalize ties with Israel. Rashan Suglam has more from Istanbul.
Turkish main opposition party, CHP, has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said, it seems AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza, adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said, Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israeli forces on Thursday raided the West Bank offices of several Palestinian NGOs, including human rights groups and civil society organizations. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry strongly condemned the raid. It warned that civil society and human rights defenders remain the prime target of Israel because they play a key role in documenting the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinians' foreign ministry has censored the raid as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
Israeli forces raided, sealed, and imposed closure orders on the offices of seven prominent Palestinian human rights and social services organizations in the West Bank. The regime claims that those NGOs have links with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or PFLP, a claim they have rejected.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil rights, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designations as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by nine European states that fund targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets, and killing all sorts of people, often at random. There are essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The lack of insight into what the U.S. Justice Department intends to do with the investigation into the former U.S. President Donald Trump's unauthorized retention of government documents has deeply frustrated the Trump legal team and aides alike in a week of perilous moments for the former president. We now present you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, U.S. Justice Department Asked Not to Disclose Affidavit Behind Mar-a-Lago Search. The U.S. Justice Department has asked a judge not to release the affidavit that gave the FBI probable cause to search Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, worsening distrust among top aides casting about for any insight into the intensifying criminal investigation surrounding the former U.S. president. The Justice Department argued the affidavit should not be unsealed because that could reveal the scope of the investigation into Trump's unauthorized retention of government secrets, just days after the Mar-a-Lago search warrant showed it referenced potential violations of three criminal statutes. FBI agents recently seized around a dozen boxes of materials, including documents marked top secret, executing a search warrant which referenced the Espionage Act, outlawing the unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or aid an adversary. The Justice Department said the affidavit would serve as a roadmap to the government's ongoing investigation, providing specific details about its direction and likely course of action, adding that it did not oppose unsealing both a cover page and a sealing order that wouldn't harm the criminal investigation. In arguing against unsealing the affidavit, the Justice Department also said that the disclosure could harm its ability to gain cooperation from witnesses, not only in the Mar-a-Lago investigation, but also additional ones that would appear to touch on the former president. Prosecutors added, "Disclosure of the government's affidavit at this stage would also likely chill future cooperation by witnesses whose assistance may be sought at this investigation as this investigation progresses, as well as in other high-profile investigations." The existence of potential witnesses who could yet cooperate in a number of investigations against Donald Trump, seemingly people with intimate knowledge of the former president's activities, rattled close advisers once more on Monday, further deepening distrust inside Trump's inner political circle. The lack of insight into what the Justice Department intends to do with the investigation into Trump's unauthorized retention of government documents has deeply frustrated the Trump legal team and aides alike in a week of perilous moments for the former president. At least one lawyer on the Trump legal team, led by former Assistant U.S. Attorney Evan Corcoran, who also acted as the lawyer for Trump's top former strategist Steve Bannon, has called up a reporter covering the story for any insight into how the Justice Department might next proceed. It added to the already fraught atmosphere inside the reduced group of advisers who have day-to-day roles around Trump that erupted shortly after the FBI departed Mar-a-Lago and sparked suspicions that a person close to the former president had become an informant for the FBI. That speculation came in part amid widening knowledge about how the FBI might have established probable cause that there was a crime being committed at Mar-a-Lago using new or recent information to prevent the probable cause from going stale through a confidential informant. According to multiple sources close to Donald Trump, suspicions initially centered on Nicholas Luna, the longtime Trump bodyguard who stepped back from his duties around March, and Molly Michael, the former Trump White House Oval Office operations chief who remains on payroll but is due to soon depart. One of the sources said Nicholas Luna was subpoenaed by the congressional investigation into the January 6th Capitol attack but has not spoken to the FBI about this case. And a source said, although Michael is slated to also leave Trump's orbit, her departure, like Nicholas Luna's, is not acrimonious. The sources said the focus in recent days shifted to Mar-a-Lago employees and other staff at the members-only resort in Palm Beach, Florida, seemingly in part because the FBI knew exactly which rooms and where in the rooms they needed to search. The sources said, but towards the weekend and following the revelation that the FBI removed a leather-bound box from the property and already knew the location of Trump's safe, scrutiny shifted once more to anyone else who had not yet been suspected, including members of Donald Trump's own family. A spokesperson for the former president did not respond to a request for comment. Calls to Trump lawyers went unanswered or straight to voicemail. The Justice Department declined to comment on the investigation or on Monday's request. Nonetheless, the sources said the escalating distrust and rampant speculation about an informant has started to reach dizzying levels, even by the standards of the Trump presidency, which was characterized in many ways by competing interests and political backstabbing. It remains unclear whether the FBI relied on confidential informants, and The Guardian first reported that the search came in part because the Justice Department grew concerned that classified materials remained at Mar-a-Lago as a result of interactions with Trump's lawyers. Confirming a New York Times report, the sources said at least one Trump lawyer signed a document, apparently falsely, attesting to the Justice Department that there were no more classified materials left at Mar-a-Lago after federal officials in June removed 10 boxes worth of government records.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So I want to try in the next little while that I have to speak, I want to look at some of the concepts of Surah Al-Fajr. Chapter 89 of the Holy Quran. I'm sure it's a chapter many of us have read. I'm sure many of us have committed this chapter to heart. And I want to see how this chapter actually fits with the revolution of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. Allah says, وَلَيَالٍ أَشَرٍ. Allah takes an oath by the 10 nights. Now again, there are multiple hadith. Many scholars have sought to interpret and understand what are these 10 nights. Some hadith point us to the 10 nights of Dhul-Hijjah. As we know, just 2 months ago, we were in the month of Dhul-Hijjah. Those 10 nights, those first nights of the month of Dhul-Hijjah, we had the recommended 2 rakat namaz between Maghrib and Isha, where we remember Musa alayhi salam and his sojourn to the mountain, and Harun alayhi salam being put in place and drawing a similitude between Rasulullah and Ghadir and these events. Maybe that's a meaning of وَلَيَالٍ أَشَرٍ. But again, you go back to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, as we always go back to these paragons of piety and enlightenment. And they tell us that these 10 nights, لَيَالٍ أَشَرٍ, could be a reference to the 10 nights of Muharram. Again, we just went through this commemorative session. Every year we've been commemorating it since the days we were in the womb of our mothers, and generations before us have commemorated Muharram. When we leave this world, communities and people that will come after us will continue these 10 nights of Muharram. Hadith tell us that one of the interpretations of Layal and Ashar are these 10 nights. And then you even look at the hadith of Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salam. We don't have hadith of the Ahlul Bayt's states from 12th of Muharram to Arba'een. We don't see them, for example, commemorating the 10th and 20th and 30th and doing the commemorative sessions that we hold. But we know for those first 10 nights, for example, we have the very famous hadith from the 8th Imam, Imam al-Radha alayhi salam, where he would say that whenever he would, Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Where the 8th Imam would say when he was a young boy that I would see my father, Imam al-Kadhim, when the night of the 1st of Muharram would dawn, he would be in a state of sadness and gloominess, and his whole demeanor would change. This is the 8th Imam saying about his father. And the 8th Imam would say, as I saw my father the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, all the way till the 9th night of Muharram, he would be in that state of, you know, being very very low key, a very mellow tone. And then on the 10th of Muharram, the day of Ashura, he says that my father's state would completely change. That this is a day of huzn, a grief and tears and lamentation for Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. So even in the Ahlul Bayt's eyes, you know, these majalis that we have, that we commemorate for 10 nights, it's not an innovation that we put together just to keep busy for 10 nights. No, the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam used to commemorate these nights in not exact same way that we do, but they had poetry, just as we have. We have the marashiyas and things in various languages. They would have people recount the maqtal or the tragedy of Karbala. They would feed people in the name of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. So we have the universal or the general principles from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And we have obviously expanded upon them due to our needs in our era, in our community, in our society, on how to keep that message alive. So Layal and Ashar could be that interpretation. But another very interesting hadith that I came across says that Layal and Ashar, so if Wal Fajr is the 12th Imam, the hadith says, one hadith says, Layal and Ashar, the 10 nights, could be a reference to the 10 Imams that come before the 12th Imam. So the 11th Imam all the way to the 2nd Imam. So you have the Hujjah as Al-Fajr, the one who will explode with his revolution of light. You have Layal and Ashar, the 11th Imam, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, all the way to the 2nd Imam. And then what happens is Allah says, وَالشَّفِّ وَالْوَتَرِ, right? By the Allah takes an oath by the even, the shaf, and the watar, the even and the odd. And here we have many, many different hadith that give us different definitions. What are the odd? What are the even? Right? What could they be? Well, we've got already 11 Imams spoken about. So some of the traditions mention that the shaf, this pair, is Imam Ali and Fatima Zahra, alayhi salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Obviously, through their union, you have the rest of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. And the watar, the individual, although I haven't seen hadith to mention Rasulullah, most of the hadith point to the fact that this watar is Allah Azza wa Jal, the one. Wahdahu la sharika la, as we say. So that doesn't exclude Rasulullah from the picture, obviously, because we know the messenger is the root of all of this. But these are some of the hadith that give us a different view or a different perspective on the 10, on the morning, on the 10, on the odd and the even. And other hadith say that it is Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhim salam, the shaf, and the watar is Imam Ali alayhim salam. Whatever the case may be, again we repeat this fact that we can never look at the Quran simply from the outside point of view. You don't just read the black on white and say, okay, this is what it means, the odd and the even. Because if you and I were to read Quran with that very simplistic mindset, well then odd and even would make absolutely no sense, right? It would just mean the odd and even. Okay, well what? Why would Allah take an oath by the odd and the even if it just means two and one, a pair and an individual? It has no basis to our guidance. And Because, as I said at the beginning, as we know that the Quran, Hudal lin-nas, it is a book of guidance for humanity. Hudal lil-alameen, a guidance to the entire universe. Hudal lil-muttaqeen, a guidance to those who have piety. The Quran has to make sense. If I can't get guidance out of Wal Fajr, why bother with Allah revealing it? If I can't get guidance from Layal and Ashar, why bother by Allah taking an oath by 10 nights when I don't know, is it the 10 nights of Rabi al-Awwal or Muharram or Dhul Hijjah or, you know, you pick the month. If it has no basis or understanding, then it serves to be worthless, na'udhu billah. And the Quran cannot be worthless. Right? Allah tells us in the Quran, you know, did we reveal all of this and create all of this in vain without a purpose? Right? So it has to have meaning and it has to resonate with our lives. And the only way, as I've said in the past and I'll say it again tonight, the only way the Quran can become relevant in our lives is through having teachers to constantly teach the book. And that means you can only get that level of guidance by following the walayat of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wa salatu wa salam, salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Without the Ahlul Bayt, you will not have this commentary. You'll just have morning, night, 10 days, 10 nights, the odd, the even. You won't get guidance. You'll move on. You'll memorize the Quran like a parrot. But you won't understand. We won't understand the depth of the Quran. So Allah says that look to the teachers, look to the guides of the Quran.
We say you live forever in our hearts and in our minds.
Oh, we say you live forever.
To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange are suing the US Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and its former director Mike Pompeo in a lawsuit filed in a New York district court on Monday, 15th of August. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Agence France-Presse. The piece is titled Julian Assange lawyers sue CIA over alleged spying. Lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange are suing the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and its former director Mike Pompeo in a lawsuit filed in a New York district court on Monday, 15th of August, alleging the agency recorded their conversations and copied data from their mobile phones and computers. The attorneys, along with two journalists joining the lawsuit, are Americans and allege that the CIA violated their U.S. constitutional protections for confidential discussions with Julian Assange, who is Australian. The suit alleges that the CIA worked with a security firm contracted by the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Assange was living at the time, to spy on the WikiLeaks founder, his lawyers, journalists, and others that he met. Julian Assange is facing extradition from Britain to the United States, where he is charged with violating the U.S. Espionage Act by publishing U.S. military and diplomatic files in 2010 related to the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. Robert Boyle, a New York attorney representing the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, said the alleged spying on Assange's attorneys means the WikiLeaks founder's right to a fair trial has now been tainted, if not destroyed. There should be sanctions, even up to dismissal of those charges, or withdrawal of an extradition request, Boyle told reporters. The lawsuit was filed by attorneys Margaret Ratner Kunstler and Deborah Herbeck, and journalists Charles Glass and John Goetz. They all visited Julian Assange while he was living inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London under political asylum, since withdrawn. The lawsuit names the CIA, former CIA director and former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and the security firm Undercover Global as defendants. The suit alleges Undercover Global, which had a security contract with the Ecuadorian embassy, swept information on their electronic devices, including communications with Julian Assange, and provided it to the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. In addition, it placed microphones around the embassy and sent recordings as well as footage from security cameras to the CIA, the lawsuit alleges. This, the attorneys claim, violated privacy protections for U.S. citizens. Julian Assange is awaiting a ruling on his appeal of the British extradition order to the United States. The charges he faces could bring a sentence of up to 175 years in prison. The lawsuit alleges that while Undercover Global controlled security at the embassy, each visitor had to leave their electronic devices with a security guard before seeing Julian Assange. The information contained on the plaintiff's devices was copied and ultimately given to the CIA, it reads. Defendant Mike Pompeo was aware of and approved the copying of information contained on plaintiff's mobile electronic devices and the surreptitious audio monitoring of their meetings with Julian Assange, the lawsuit claims. Meanwhile, Julian Assange's family have said the Australian government needs to intervene in the case before Julian is extradited to the United States, saying it would effectively be a death sentence for the WikiLeaks founder if there was no intervention. The plight of Julian Assange, who is being held in Britain's Belmarsh prison pending an appeal against his extradition to the United States, has been raised with the new US ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy, by Julian Assange's Australian solicitor, Stephen Kenny. Assange's father, John Shipton, and his brother, Gabriel Shipton, had raised concern that there had been little progress made since the May election and urged the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, to make the issue non-negotiable with the US. The family expressed frustration that they had been unable to secure a meeting with either Prime Minister Anthony Albanese or Foreign Minister Penny Wong. Since the election, Anthony Albanese has said the government intends to pursue the matter diplomatically, saying, "Not all foreign affairs is best done with a loud hailer." Gabriel Shipton, Julian Assange's brother said he had initially been encouraged by Albanese's remarks as opposition leader that enough is enough with regards to Assange's incarceration, but was frustrated with a lack of progress since last May's election.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wa Allahu akbar.
These Ashura morning gatherings develop such mothers who urge their sons to go to the war fronts, and if they do not return, the mothers wish they had more sons to send, or say, we have other sons to send to the war fronts. These lamentation meetings to observe the Karbala tragedy, the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein, and the prayers, including the Kumail prayer and other prayers, were initiated early by Islam and intended to advise with this idea and program. If others could understand or be made to understand the reason for the morning sessions and why so much value is placed on these special tears that are shed and their reward with Allah, they surely would not call us the nation of tears. Instead, they would call us the nation of epic.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, welcome to the program Spring of Truth with the wise sayings and counsels of Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh, the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. So in this program, we try to quote some of the sayings and statements and sentences that Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah has uttered on different occasions and places, and we try to elaborate on them and explain about them from our own perspective. In this program, I chose one which deals with the issue of fault-finding, you know, with regards to other people and just closing your eyes on your own problems and shortcomings and just focusing your attention on other people's problems. So he says, no fault is greater than not understanding one's own fault and ignoring it. Although one is a collection of faults himself, he is concerned with the faults of others. This is so true about so many people. It's so painful to be in touch with someone whose fingers are always pointed at you or some other people and never at, you know, himself or herself.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi salli ala
When they do something wrong and when people start to blame them, they constantly try to search for someone to put the blame or the problem on them. And after a while, what happens is that you get really sick of these people, you get really tired of them, and you don't want to be around them anymore. And you just gradually try to put a distance between yourself and them and just get them out of your life because you get sick and tired of them. And the other problem is that they will never grow and flourish. I'm trying to like talk from the perspective of that person who is always trying to put his fingers, you know, point his fingers at other people's problems and faults and never look at himself. That person will actually never grow, will never flourish. And that is very sad. Thank you very much for being with us in this program. Until our next program, God bless you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
What kind of place is a hay'at? It is a place for struggle on the path of Allah. A hay'at is the center of struggle on the path of Allah. It is struggle on the path of Allah to revive the school of the Ahlul Bayt, the school of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and the school of martyrdom. Well, in what kind of endeavor were the Imams engaged in? The Imams did not engage in military struggle except for a few of them. Only the commander of the faithful, Imam Hassan Mujtaba and Imam Hussein fought with swords. The rest of the Imams did not fight with swords. So, what was their struggle? It was struggle for clarification. When I repeatedly speak about clarification or the struggle for clarification, the hay'ats are places for the struggle of clarification. In my opinion, from this sentence, keep our issue alive, this important point can be understood. Another point about the hay'ats is that they are an institution that enjoys meaning, movement, and dynamism. They are not only places for thinking, spirituality, studying, and teaching. Movement and dynamism exist in the hay'ats as well. The main issue is the school of thought and clarification of the school of thought.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the hay'ats, the school of thought is clarified. When I say that it is clarified, I mean that it should be clarified. This is the nature of hay'ats. They are places for clarification and expressing the most important teachings of Islam and Imam Ali. These are places for answering questions. Today, our youth have various questions regarding lifestyle and other fundamental issues, and their questions are legitimate. The way to deal with questions is to think and answer them, and this should be done in hay'ats. The important centers for such endeavors are hay'ats. It is in hay'ats that the numerous questions that arise every day should be answered. It is all right to have questions, but he who has a question should know that it is due to his lack of knowledge that his question has arisen. This question can be turned into knowledge and understanding. A person who has a question should not think that everything is upside down. No, his question should be asked, and that's all right. The answer should be provided in hay'ats, in centers of knowledge and understanding. This is the meaning and essence of hay'ats.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.